Tech Talk with Jess Kelly. This is News Talk.
Yeah, you're very welcome along to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Coming up over the next hour, we'll get an update on the rollout of the National Broadband Plan and find out when the last of the homes will be connected. I'll chat to the organiser of the BT Young Scientists and Technology Exhibition about the plans for the 61st edition of the event. And as ever, I'll answer your tech questions. You can get in touch right now. Drop me an email to techtalk@newstalk.com or you'll find me on Instagram at Jess Kelly. Last week on the show, myself and John Riley were talking about the new Google Pixel devices. I'm so excited because all three versions of the Pixel 9 landed on my desk. And I'm going to talk about my first impressions a little bit later on in the show. But we are going to kick off this week with the National Broadband Plan. This is one of those stories that feels like it's gone on for as long as I can remember now at this stage. We have covered it extensively here on News Talk, following the initial vision, the procurement process, the dropping out of potential bidders, and ultimately the awarding of the contract and the establishment of National Broadband Ireland. Work has been ongoing over the last number of years, and I'm delighted to say that Peter Hendrick, the CEO of NBI, is with me now. Peter, it's been a while since we've chatted, but work has obviously continued on the rollout. Can you bring us up to speed as to where we are as of this week?
Thanks, Jess. Delighted to be with you today. It's gone really, really well. What we've announced over the last week is that we've now technically passed and ready for service over 50% of the homes in the National Broadband Plan. So the total number of homes in the National Broadband Plan today sits at 564,000 premises, and we've gone ready for service and connecting homes over 283,000. Now, in terms of total numbers, we've got a lot more than that actually under construction. So we have 83% of the entire project where we've either, as I said, ready for service or under construction. So we're continuously releasing about 10,000 homes ready for service. So there are homes that can pre-order and order. So today we have about 300,000 homes and businesses that ultimately can place an order to get connected to this high-speed fibre broadband network. So really, really positive momentum in the project.
Yeah, it's great to hear that momentum because we know that COVID caused some delays, and we might talk through some of that. And then also, as you said, those who are waiting to be connected. But I always like to clarify some of the language used around the National Broadband Plan, because as you alluded to there, there are different stages. It's not the case of, you know, you send out 50 vans to go out this morning, dig up the road and lay the cable. As I learned when I went out with your team a few years ago, there's a whole host of surveying that goes on before a bit of dirt is touched. Has all the surveying now been done?
Yeah, we're nearly completed on survey. We've 93% of the entire country surveyed. So just put it in context of scale, we're talking about 100,000 kilometres of road network. Ultimately, we are rolling out a fibre-based network. So we're talking about, you know, bringing fibre across the country. So we've got to survey all of that road network, where we have to dig up roads, where we've got to repair existing underground duct network, where we've got to replace timber poles or put in new timber poles. But 93% of that survey is completed, and just over 90% of the designs now are completed of those surveys. So as you can imagine, we're really coming to the end of that survey activity, which should be finished within the next 6 months. And then ultimately, you want to get onto the build phase. But even before you get onto the build phase, we have to go around to all the local authorities. So we're active in all 26 counties, plus of the 27 main islands around the country. We've got 10 completed, we've got 17 underway. We have to deal with local authorities in terms of road opening licenses, give them, you know, plans of what we're doing and the time we're going to do it on. So there's a huge coordination before you actually start doing any activity. And as you said, when COVID hit, we'd only started the project about 12 weeks when COVID ultimately hit in March of 2022, and we had lockdowns. And as you can imagine, you know, trying to send surveyors around the country, you know, checking this infrastructure, and particularly if you've got teams together, you know, at one stage we had to put perspex glass between the driver and the passenger and vehicles. in terms of obviously, you know, for health and safety reasons. And that was a real issue, I suppose, certainly for the first 24 months of the project, and set us back quite significantly. It put the program behind by up to 18 months. But thankfully, in terms of where we're at today, we believe now we can bring it back in the original time plan, because we're at scale and we have quite a significant number of contractors, over 2,000 people on the ground now working on the project. And we've got that momentum. So all of the survey and design work now coming to conclusion. All of the build activity, 83% now under construction. You know, by early next year, we'll have everything under construction, with clear line of sight to completing the main build work in 2026.
Were there learnings in that early period, despite the COVID hiccup? As soon as your workers, took to the ground, were efficiencies identified? Was there new ways of working, or are we still operating under the plan that was laid out on day one?
Definitely. I mean, efficiencies, we've definitely seen efficiencies. Probably one of the things that we were different to a number of commercial operators in terms of how they deploy. We invested heavily in the survey and design activities, because we wanted, not ultimately we knew the homes that we were making available to connect to. So I think investing in that up front and building IT systems or technology systems that improves service provisioning and service assurance. And obviously, you're always going to have outliers. But in a lot of, in the commercial world, what typically happens with telecom operators is they will build a network, and then they will connect the homes that they can, and the ones that they can't, they just leave them. And that's in essence why the National Broadband Plan exists, if you want to think of it like that. It can be cost prohibitive or it can be technically challenging, whereas we've identified the 564,000 premises. In our network design, every single home has an identified network connection point with a physical port, a physical optical port where they connect into the network. And we've left capacity then for growth over the next 25 years, 35 years, if we think about the long-term view of the contract. So we've left capacity to add more homes in. We've got the fiber count to add more homes in and businesses. So really, we've future-proofed. Whereas a typical commercial operator, you know, would have an investment horizon, you know, that might span, you know, 5, 8, 10 years. And the decisions we were able to make in our survey and design, and even things we learned on the ground as we mobilized, I think is going to give us much more certainty in our provisioning, our lifetime assurance, the operations in the network, and sustainability of real future-proof multiple gigabit, you know, tens or hundreds of gigabits of connectivity to premises over the next 35 years, which is definitely, just to give you an example of it, we had the broadband competency office over from, this is a let's call it a group from all 27 EU member states. They were over in Dublin in the month of June, and we showcased the National Broadband Plan and NBI's delivery of the National Broadband Plan. They came out to our office, and it was about 50 people in total came out, and we were probably one of the earlier countries to commit to full fiber back in 2018, 2019 in terms of our program. You know, we're looking at alternative technologies as a kind of a bridging gap, but they didn't look at it over 25 years. They were looking at kind of 10-year type state aid type approaches to the challenge. But since COVID, everybody is focused on gigabit connectivity and future-proofing the networks. And I think at a European level, the 2030 gigabit connectivity program, where every premise in Europe should have access to gigabit connectivity by 2030, has changed that mindset and the approach that the Department of Communication had taken between 2015 and ultimately 2020 when we started the project. I think definitely they're looking at what we've done in Ireland and looking at how it should be done in other countries that are not as far on, or certainly countries that started before us but now have a tail, and that tail is probably the ones that are hardest to hit, and they're considering how do they now bridge the gap between where they built fiber. Do they continue on with the fiber? They ultimately will have to, given where speeds and demand is going to go for the future. So definitely we a lot of learnings, and I think the approach that was taken in Ireland is definitely, we're one of the leaders in Europe on that basis.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, you know, the National Broadband Plan is something that rightly faced a fair bit of criticism and hot takes for all of the years that the conversations were going on around it. But as the progress continues and as more homes get connected, the benefit of it is definitely there. But I know, as I'm talking to you right now, somebody who hasn't been connected yet or who hasn't, you know, been passed for connection as of yet is going to start writing me an email going, am I going to be the last home in Ireland to get connected? Can you just explain the methodology that went on to identify the areas to hit? Like, is it the case? Is this assumption that, you know, all the low-hanging fruit was done first and then the tricky homes and the Bohareens and all the rest would be left to the very end? Is that the case?
No, and I can appreciate, look, anybody who's been notified. So, you know, ultimately, you can go to NBI's website, nbi.ie, put your air code in, and we do clarify, you know, when you're likely to be able to connect to the network. And for some, that's 2025 and 2026. I suppose the definition of homes that are in the intervention area, the National Broadband Plan, was a 30 megabits threshold. So if you had greater than 30 megabits per second, at the time, obviously, now we're talking about it should be gigabits per second or hundreds of megabits per second, but it was 30 megabits per second. If you had less than 30 megabits per second, you were in the National Broadband Plan. So those homes are really everywhere. They're all over the country, from some urban town centres all the way out to, you know, obviously the islands off the west coast of Ireland. And our mandate or requirement under the contract was we had to be active within the first 24 months in every single county, and every county had to be progressing at the same rate. So we are on average, if you think about it, if we say 80% construction under construction, it's on average 83% across the entire country. So every single county has its equivalent share of that total under construction or available for service being over 50% today. But as we come out, I suppose I mean define in terms of how we build out the network, we ultimately have to bring the fiber from where we have existing connectivity today. So in each county, we have a let's call it a center point of presence, which are 72 retail operators. So NBI is a wholesale operator. One of our 72 retail operators can avail of a service in that location, and we bring the fiber out to the homes and businesses in each deployment area. Now, across the entire country, we have 227 what we call local exchanges, if you want to think of it like that. Typically, in the old copper network, there was over 1,400 local exchanges. In a fiber network, we don't need as many exchanges because the fiber connectivity can go longer. So if you think about a radial distance of that local exchange, it's around 25 kilometers. So we've lots of these kind of 25-kilometer radial fiber networks. But each of those points, each of those local exchanges needs to be connected back to another one. So we can only build if you think of it going around in a ring, connecting each one of those local exchanges, there's no point in us going to a place and building a ring or building a local exchange, and we've no way to bring the fiber back to a central exchange. So as we design out the network, we're going from one local exchange to another. And as we're doing, we're bringing fiber from local exchange to local exchange. So it has to be built out on that basis, one after another, rather than, and we do that on a county by county basis. So it's not that we can simply pull stuff or pull the areas forward. It has to be built out in kind of like a Lego basis. But I can tell you some of the locations that were live today, such as the Black Valley, we're going live next month. The Black Valley was the last place in Ireland to get rural electrification in 1976. So, you know, there might be places in, as you said, there might be people in more closer to urban centres that are finding that they're not getting connected until 2025 or 2026. And it's purely because of that kind of Lego brick approach to building out the network. But equally, Black Valley, because we're doing it in the same approach, we're just in a part of Kerry that actually it's the next part in the block of build. And, you know, people who were the last to get access to rural electrification are now getting connected to fiber, you know, let's call it just over halfway to the midpoint of the project. So it's, you know, all boats are rising at the same time is the best way of describing it.
Mm. And I think that, you know, the mention of the electrification, that is so important. I always refer to it, you know, but I've read different politicians, different ministers who held the role of Minister for Communications over the since 2007, I think. And pretty much every single one of them said, you know, this is as vital a utility as electricity. And obviously during the pandemic, that just got hammered home even more. Another one of the points that cropped up, say in like 2018, 2019, about the National Broadband Plan was not everybody will want it. So is there any point in going around and rolling it out across the entire country? What can you tell me about the uptake and the interest level and the queries that you've had from parts of the country? Like, is that notion of not everybody wants it or needs it, is that sort of dead and gone now?
I think what we've found, I suppose, is that the demand is higher. It's higher than we had predicted, and COVID definitely, and remote working had a massive impact on that, and education from home as well. I think what we found is our take up when we go ready for service in areas. So the minute we say the network is turned on in a location within that 25-kilometer radius, we see about 32 to 33% take up straight away. And again, it's our retail operators. So they're offering, you know, we provide the connectivity, and then our retail operators provide the service. So that whether that's the, you know, the typical, your larger retail operators such as Vodafone, Sky, or Virgin, or Air, or some of the more regional operators, of which we've got 72 in total, they're out offering consumers product choice, competitive pricing, you know, additional in-home services such as, you know, additional TV points for your set-top boxes or Wi-Fi access points. And so there's a mixture of opportunities in terms of products, and their demand stimulation on top of our demand stimulation is finding actually we're getting quite a high take-up. And what happens over time then is we incrementally get more and more homes connecting to the network. And today we would see it that after about 2 years of being live in an area, we're somewhere north of 50% take-up. But it takes time because some homes may already have an existing or legacy broadband service, and they may be in contract. So they're just waiting for their contract to expire, or maybe they haven't upgraded, you know, such as they haven't upgraded their TVs to smart TVs. So there is always going to be that timing piece, but definitely relative to what other European equivalents have found is NBI or the National Broadband Plan certainly is ahead of the curve in that take-up journey. And I do look at it, I look at it akin to what happened with rural electrification. So when we were building out this project under rural electrification, what we found, we were comparing it to rural electrification. You know, there was an article out there saying that only 30% of people wanted electricity back in the 1960s. So comparing that to where we are today in terms of fiber, we know that fiber is going to be perceived as a utility technology, and gigabit connectivity, something that's going to be needed in high demand for 80, 90% of the population, if not more.
One aspect of the contract for the National Broadband Plan was, as you alluded to earlier on, the future-proofing of the technology, but also the maintenance of the network as well. How does that work? And I know I'm probably putting the cart before the horse here, but when the project is completed, I'm assuming that NBI is not going to pack up shop and cease from existence.
No, certainly not. I mean, ultimately, we'll continue to connect homes. Once the network is built, we'll be connecting homes as people want the service. And then over the life, I suppose, in terms of operating this network, we're contracted to continue to run this network for all the way out to 2055, and we'll continue to run it beyond 2055. And what's really important there is we operate proactive and reactive maintenance and assurance, because, you know, there's always going to be repairs and upgrades to the network. A couple of key things ultimately is consumers still have the ability to move between one retail operator and another. And that could be based on the product choices, the speeds, or the price point that the retail operator is charging. So consumers still have the choice to move between retail operators, and it should be pretty straightforward. I mean, it's an electronic move. In some cases, the new retail operator will need to send out equipment, you know, new router or new TV set-top box or whatever they are. So there's the operations in terms of ensuring new service orders are delivered. But then on the assurance side, obviously, we will have, you know, customer service impacting in terms of whether that's damaged the network through storms, or whether it's simply, you know, some queries in terms of something's going wrong with a service. And the key thing that we have is ensuring that we have there's still quite a number of engineers on the ground, you know, provisioning connections and also providing assurance over the next 35 plus years. But ultimately, I suppose the key point is if you're living in an area that's connected to the national broadband network, you will get the equivalent service that you would get if you were living in an urban area, both in terms of speed and assurance. And that's the targets that we're held to under our contract with the minister. So in 20 years' time, if you can get 100 gigabits per second off a commercial operator in Dublin, the National Broadband Plan will be providing the same service, whether that's on an island or in the Black Valley. So we will continue to operate and run this network and give certainty, I suppose, of that service for the full term of the contract.
Mm-hmm. And then my final question, just listening to you speak there, I suppose it hammers home one point that I know David McCourt made in an interview with me before is the need and the necessity of collaboration. So whether that is between yourselves and the department, yourselves and the internet service providers, yourselves and the consumer, this really is a collaborative process, and it will continue to be for the lifespan of the contract.
Yeah, look, I think it's what are we using the network for? I mean, I think part of the concern around take up was, you know, is everybody going to switch to, you know, streaming Netflix, and is that all this network is going to be used for? And I think what we found is, you know, that the working with the likes of Irish Farmers Association and others, you start to realize the benefits and, you know, technologies that can be used over having ubiquitous connectivity, particularly gigabit ubiquitous connectivity. You know, 20 years ago, I worked for an engineering company called Siemens, and we talked about, you know, fixed mobile convergence and how everybody was going to be connected and everything was going to be connected, you know, number portability, all these things. And you could just stream from one network to the other. We were trying to sell technology in the back of that. And really, I think COVID revolutionized that. Instead of it was an evolution. And it really made everybody realize that actually software has a major impact in terms of how we live our lives. And the technology is getting cheaper. I think, you know, whether that's smart home, smart technology within businesses, smart farming, I think connectivity is definitely accelerating. And software equally. We could talk for another hour about the impact that AI is going to have in a positive sense. And I think where David is coming from it is the impact of AI and how we can use AI for good, and that it's not always a threat, that there's opportunities to collaborate, get the best out of all technologies. Same way, to a certain extent, of how important GPS is today in everybody's life. We don't really think about it, but the technology is actually quite old. But I guarantee you 90% of people use GPS in their everyday life, whether that's just getting, you know, to and from the shops or driving long distances. It's a critical technology, and I suppose connectivity is part of that kind of foundation as a critical technology. And the National Broadband Plan is a critical infrastructure on that basis.
Yes, indeed. And it's great to hear the progress is continuing. And no doubt we will be speaking again. But for the moment, Peter Hendrick, thank you so much.
Thanks, Jess. Appreciate the time.
As Peter mentioned, if you are in the intervention area, you'll be able to find out a rough ETA by going to nbi.ie/map and you just put in your air code. But as ever, I'd love to hear your experience. Have you already been connected? What has been the benefit or the impact of that? Or maybe you're still waiting. What are you doing in the meantime? You can email me techtalk@newstalk.com. Now, when we come back here on News Talk, we'll hear from the organisers of the BT Young Scientists and Technology Exhibition.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Now I'm gone, but you're still laying next to me, 1 degree of separation.
Snippet of Sabrina Carpenter's new song Taste, and the reason I'm playing it is because that track was used to launch a new feature on Instagram. If you were around in the MySpace days, it may sound familiar, but bear with me. You can now add a song to your profile. So if you're an Instagram user, you can go to your profile, you can hit edit and select up to a 30-second clip of a song. Now, unlike MySpace, it doesn't automatically play, but there you go. It just shows you that good ideas tend to show up time and time again. But it got us chatting here in the News Talk office during the week. What song would you add to your profile, or would you be bothered? I got quite excited about this when I heard about it, but I've yet to do it. And I need to have a think as to what the song would be. And also, would anyone be arse clicking on it? Let me know, techtalk@newstalk.com. Now, every January, I head out from Newstalk Towers and I walk 20 minutes out towards the RDS in Donnybrook to stroll around the floor of the BT Young Scientist and Technology Exhibition. It is one of my favourite events of the year and it always sets the tone, I feel. And I'm delighted to say that Mary Callahan, the head of the BT Young Scientist and Technology Exhibition, is with me now. Mary, as I've said to you before, and I've said it on pretty much every show on this station, taking part in this event when I was in third and fourth year was one of the best things I did during my time in secondary school. I still, to this day, believe it brought me out of my shell and it helped me develop a bit of confidence. For those who've never taken part, talk us through the entire concept, because it's much more than just an education showcase.
So the BT Young Scientist and Technology Exhibition has been going now for 61 years. So it's sort of the biggest school science exhibition in Ireland. So science, technology, engineering and maths are at the core. So we ask anybody across any secondary school in Ireland to consider putting projects in, and that's across all of the scientific categories and everything else. So it can be an individual, it can be a group of two or a group of three, and the students get to work on projects and subject matter that's close to their hearts or something that they're learning in school and everything else. So as you said, Jess, going to the RDS every January is just eye-opening. And I just don't know how the students come up with the new ideas every year. But like, the innovation and the curiosity of the show is absolutely unsurpassed.
Yeah, I was blown away yet again this year as I walked around the halls. And, you know, I suppose you're seeing proper innovation on display, but there's also a broad spectrum of topics covered as well. There's a mix of the traditional scientific, maybe it's a chemistry-based project, and then in the same row, you've got students looking at, you know, how hurleys made of different kinds of wood impact the swing or the impact and so on. Like, the scope and opportunity for students to take part in this, it's not just within the realms of that sort of narrow academic definition of science?
No, not at all. We like to see it as a platform for exploration. So years and years ago, it might have been seen as a more academic exhibition. And I hope over the 25 years that BT have been custodian of the event that we sort of moved the goalposts as such on that as well. And it's just about what the students are interested in, looking at things in a novel and a different way. And that really, really helps. And like anything I do, and Dr. Tony Scott and myself, when we talk about this, we would encourage the students to look at something that they're really, really interested in. And out of that springs the most amazing ideas. You have very personal stories when it comes to a family illness or something, and then students looking at, could they help help with the problem that's there? As you talked about the hurleys and all the rest, it's always are the sports people amongst us trying to make things better and quicker and everything else. But I think what really stands out every year as well is that the students look at sort of in two different ways. They look at what's in the here and now. So if you look last year, and you know, Jess, that there would have been a lot of projects on AI last year. And in fact, our winning project, which is going to Europe, to the European Young Scientists next month, was around AI. But you also look at the students that sort of that just want to look at the topical things as well, and what's out there as well. And they explore in that way. So the environment is always sort of one that wins out as well. But just the novel way that the young people look at the ideas is unbelievable.
I've spoken to Dr. Tony Scott over the last number of years, and I saw him earlier in the year. And one thing that he is always so proud of is not only the scientific and innovative projects that come out of this, but also the development of the soft skills of the students. Because I know from my time, when I took part, you have to explain your project to the judges. You have people coming up and asking you questions about it. So the communication and the connection side of things is equally as important alongside the STEM side of things as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you think that you're there, so to get through, you put your project in, you've qualified for. So you've had to sit down and look at scientific research, look at putting a one-page proposal together and everything else. So that in itself is a learning experience. But when you're there in front of your project, the one that you're expert in, you gain confidence by talking about it. Our judges, as you know, Dr. Tony is the co-founder, and along with about 85 other people are going around. They have a wonderful way about them. They're there to question the students about their projects. As I said, they're the experts in their own projects. So the students are gaining real confidence from doing that as well. Their public speaking as such. So, and they have to look at their pitches in different ways. So talking to a judge versus talking to somebody from the general public that comes along, you have to tell your story in a different way. And then another area we see is when students start working together as part of a group of two or three, the collaboration skills they get from that is absolutely wonderful as well. So like I'm lucky enough to know and meet quite a few of the alumni every year. And they always will come back to that and how it really, really has helped them focus on what they want to do, that and has given them confidence to maybe look at a different path than they were going down as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know for sure that is true for myself. A big part of the event every year, aside from yourselves and BT, those ideas and the students, is of course the teachers who support and back the students taking part. How important is the collaboration with the teachers every year?
It's absolutely massive. Without a teacher being involved, in a lot of cases the students couldn't become involved. The teachers as well as the students put their heart and their souls into a project. Like we call them educators rather than teachers in some ways, and we have Educator of Excellence Awards for every category as well, because we know how important their role is, of nurturing them, of bringing them along, of helping build their confidence and guide them, not come up with the project ideas, not to do all the research or anything else, and it's that gentle hand to guide and everything else. And like we've had wonderful situations, and one springs to mind this year where we had a young teacher who had brought his own projects from his new school forward, and he didn't tell his old science teacher, who had gone through the process of being his mentor for his project a number of years ago, that he was going to be there. So we caught on camera the two of them meeting up. Mm. And it was a lovely moment. So that's what you've got. You've got that generational thing as well with the teachers as well, that you will see some of the competitors have gone on to be teachers because of their teachers as well and their experience through the BT Young Scientist.
Yeah, the atmosphere is always electric. Talk to me a little bit about, you know, what people need to consider, because perhaps there's people who are contemplating putting a project in, but they maybe haven't even thought about it. How do they go about it? Does it all come through the schools?
Yeah, it goes through the schools. So we're waiting for the Leaving Cert results to come out. So once that's done, so from the first week in school, we are sending out mailings to all of the schools next week. So an email giving them information and our fact file. So the fact file is a mine of information for people. And as is our website, so www.btyoungscientist.com. So the basis of the project is, of course, the idea. But then we ask for the students to fill out an application form. And if they're doing anything that is research-based, like questionnaire-based and all the rest, they have a few more little questions to answer for us then. And it's a crucial one-page proposal. So laying out what your idea is, what you want to do with that idea, how you feel you can research that idea, and what you hope the results are. Now, it's by no means a finished project. It's an ideation at this stage, very much so. The teachers then are asked to fill out their commentary on it, just to say that, yes, they think that it can be done in the time and the access to equipment or whatever else. So that is the basis of a project. And what we've done is we have a project finder on the website as well, so people can put in sort of a one word or two, as many words as they want to do a search on all of the qualified projects over the last 12 years, I think is what we've loaded up now as well. So it gives them an idea if their project idea has been done before or what way it's been explored before, just to give a little bit of novelty and stuff around it as well. So that's where it is. Closing date, 27th of September. Ample time for anybody who's thinking about it, or not even, more importantly, not even thinking about it, to get an idea together.
Yeah, and I can't stress enough how beneficial I found it when I was a teenager. That portal of previous projects is a great idea because you see so many brilliant projects as you walk through the floor. And I'm sure, you know, if I was to walk through now, it might spark something in my brain. So it's a great launch pad for students to go in and maybe get inspired. I'm sure that just because a topic has been covered before, that doesn't discount it from ever being featured again, right?
No, not at all. Not at all. Science never stops. So one tiny little sort of thought or movement in a different direction just opens up another field of exploration, really. So, absolutely. There's so much there. What we don't want are the projects that have been done time and time again. And that's why we put that together a number of years ago, that we're sort of saying, look, something has been done to death. And when we don't qualify projects, we sort of give that feedback. So we're just trying to help by saying, look, go on to that, have a look at that. You'll know what's been done before. So if your idea has been done before, maybe look at it from a different angle or look at a different idea. So to give yourself more of a chance to qualify.
Yeah, the success stories from the event over the last number of years, it's just been phenomenal to watch it and the impact of it. You know, as you alluded to earlier on, the Irish event isn't the end of it. We see so many participants go on, not just winners, but other participants going on to some incredible things. That must be a great source of pride for yourself and the team to see people come through your doors and then go on from strength to strength.
Oh, it really, really does. We don't talk about our alumni as just our winners. We talk about everybody that's ever taken part. You're part of that family as well, Jess. But then talking about our winners, they do go on and represent Ireland so well as the only Irish project representing, the only official represented project in Ireland. So there's sort of a lot of weight on the shoulders of the young person that's taking part on our behalf, because we really have a good reputation there. Next week will be the 36th edition of the European, or sorry, a couple of weeks will be the 36th edition of the European Union Contest for Young Scientists in Poland. And Ireland have won first place 17 out of the previous 35 of those. So we really, really do well. And it just shows about the high level of the projects that we are seeing overall the years in Ireland, and the way that the students are researching and how they're coming up with their ideas and stuff as well. A lot to do with our education system as well, because it's a lot more advanced than it would be in other countries. And just the fact that the students have that sort of springboard and platform that they can explore through, which is the Young Scientist.
I mentioned walking around the RDS in January. I'm sure your team is already busy beavering away, trying to pull out more stops for this coming January. In terms of it being an exhibition and something that school children and families and adults want to walk around, how much time, effort, blood, sweat and tears and all the rest goes into the production element of it?
A lot. Because we could wash and rinse and just not come up with any new innovations, new things to do and all the rest. And we always look at that. So we'll be announcing sort of later in September, just a small initiative to mark BT's 25th year as custodian. So there's always different things. So we always look at sort of the elements. So as well as the competition, we've got the Primary Science Fair, which we also developed, which is 25 years old this year as well. And that's absolutely joyous to visit on the Thursday and Friday. The younger people are just so invigorated by the discovery of science and everything else that they tell their stories so well. We have an amazing exhibition hall, which is thankfully virtually sold out at this stage, where we've got 60 plus exhibitors coming along, telling them why they want students to get involved in STEM, talking about their companies, that sort of thing. It's not sort of one of those things that you go along, have to open your wallet and all the rest. People just want to talk. Mm-hmm. And so people can learn more about STEM. And then we have our 3D theatre, and we have new and different shows every year on the main stage as well. So it's all about looking at science, looking at STEM in different ways. So it's not just the projects. They're the core part of what we do, but it's everything else we've built around it for maybe something there will spark the curiosity of a young person as they walk through.
Hopefully, indeed. So finally, let's just wrap this up here now with some top tips for students who are contemplating putting a project together. Is there anything in particular beyond just the portal that students should keep an eye out for? Are there any particular themes you're hoping to see on the floor, or do you like that eclectic mix of everything and anything?
The mix of the projects is, I think, what makes it. It would be very formulaic, and I know from counterparts across the European competition, sometimes they go for a theme or whatever else. It just doesn't work that way because not everybody is as interested in something as others. So that's really, really important. So the top tips are, look at, if you're doing something that you've got to do a lot of experimentation and everything else in, have you enough time to do that? So there's no point in putting a project in that will need a 2-year sort of research project around it, because the judges won't see the results that they'd like to see in that. So make sure you've got time. Make sure you have the interest in your topic. Make sure you have the buy-in of your teachers and your family and your friends and everybody else. If you're doing something that is more of sort of questionnaire basis, that sort of qualitative research and quantitative research, make sure your base is big enough that you get to see real results. Like doing a questionnaire with 10 of your mates is not the same as looking at a data set for 100 people. So look at things like that. And just keep on asking questions. Like we've actually updated quite a few of our tips this year. So look at the website, because we're sort of saying, look, ask yourself, are you looking at things in the right way? Are you doing everything else? So we've built that sort of tips part in our resources this year, where we just want to give as many people the opportunity not to be daunted by putting a project in, and just to give them help to do it.
Great stuff. Well, look, as I said, I'm already looking forward to the event, and no doubt we'll chat in January. Thank you so much.
Thanks a million, Jess.
Yeah, that was Mari Callahan of the BT Young Scientist and Technology Exhibition. Now, when we come back here on News Talk, I'll answer your tech questions.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. John Friday has stopped by to preview what's coming up on this week's Screen Time. John, what's on the show?
The great Australian comedian Adam Hills. He's actually an MBE. People may know he has a prosthetic prosthetic foot, I should say, and he's been very open about it. He's even done comedy gigs where he's encouraged the audience to pass it around. He's a keen sportsman, and he wanted to compete in tennis, and the only tennis open to him was wheelchair tennis. So he's on this campaign to get para standing tennis into a Grand Slam event in the Paralympics. Fascinating story, and a great and charming comedian. There's a brilliant new prison drama, I'm calling it a prison drama in a way nearly does it a disservice, called Sing Sing, all about the prison Sing Sing, where all these incarcerated people get involved in making plays and putting on plays. And it's a true story, even though it's fictionalized. And the lack of recidivism when people get involved in the arts in prison is incredible. The statistics are almost staggering in terms of people not reoffending once they're involved in the arts. I checked this out during the week. I went down a bit of a rabbit hole with it. And they've turned this idea into a brilliant movie called Sing Sing, which is getting Oscar buzz, and rightly so. I'm talking to the director of that. And then we have the week's new releases, which which include a fascinating documentary all about Mary Robinson called Mrs. Robinson.
Oh, fab. Okay, great. That's a nice little mix.
Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah, well done you. The Oscar buzz, does that just kick off from now? Is now when we get the Oscar bait and so on?
Well, it's really from any time the last Oscars end back in March. But it's there are some movies and it's like... Rarely I say this, right? Because the Oscars are a machine. Hmm. And it's an industry. But sometimes a movie, and this sounds like I'm overing it, but sometimes a movie is so good, Oscar buzz happens about it. It hits certain notes and you think this is going to be an Oscar contention. So Oscar buzz usually starts later than this, but because this is so good, I would say, and probably, and it's not to do it a disservice, but it ticks certain Oscar boxes, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It's right on the money. And as I say, that's not to do it a disservice, but I think it's getting Oscar buzz rightly so. But what you have to bear in mind is as well, that happens a lot. And then come the Oscars, it mightn't be nominated. I've been caught out many times in that before saying, this is going to sweep the boards. And then it doesn't even get nominated, you know?
Yeah. Right. Well, I will be tuning in just after six, John.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All of that is on the way in just a few minutes' time. But before I let you go, I mentioned it earlier on the show, but the new Pixel devices landed on my desk for review the other day. And I did something that's massive in my world. You ready? I moved away entirely from the iPhone 15 and my beloved Apple Watch to the Pixel 9 Pro and the Pixel Watch 3. This is something that I had spoken about for a while. I've said numerous times that the only reason I was really still with iPhone was because of the Apple Watch. But I took the plunge and I've shimmied across to both. And I have to say, I am obsessed so far. I'll have a full review on Tuesday's Pat Kenny show, but the Pixel 9 Pro really impressed me. I would say at this stage already that this is the best Android phone on the market. The model I'm using, as I said, is the Pro. So that has the 6.3-inch screen. Inside, you've got 16 gigs of RAM, which is bananas. Most laptops don't even have that. And then Google's own Tensor G4 chip inside as well. It means that it is incredibly pacey and powerful, and I haven't noticed a single snag with it. It has just blown me away. The two things that stood out so far, number one is the camera, and number two is the AI. Now, I know some people will probably roll their eyes at the talk of AI yet again, but there are some aspects of it that are so genuinely useful, and it's just kind of fun to use. So out of the box on the Pixel 9 Pro, if you long press the home button, so you know the button that you'd normally press to like lock a screen or whatever, if you long press that, it brings up Gemini, which is their version of ChatGPT. I'm sure they won't like that, but their AI assistant. All of the bits are there. It can do things like it can transcribe what I'm talking about. So I can talk into it, is what I'm trying to say. I can type into it or I can share a photo. And the responses have been class. Like, it's been a bit of fun to use. And I think as I get more used to interacting with it, I'll find more practical uses for it, if you know what I mean. But I have to say, I really like that. The other feature that I've used an awful lot, and this is probably just maybe the nature of my job, but I don't know if other people would find it useful too, the voice recorder. So I'd always use the voice recorder app on any phone that I'm using, whether it's when I'm doing interviews or whether I'm in meetings. But the live transcription tool on the Google Pixel 9 Pro is amazing. I did an interview the other day and I took the phone out and I just tried it just to see what it was like. And the accuracy with different Irish accents is very impressive. It's actually useful. Sometimes I've used other transcription services before that you have to pay for, and they would struggle with the Irish accent. But I have to say, I've been very much enjoying it so far. The cameras are the other thing that I mentioned there. If you're after the best image quality with just a simple point and shoot, I don't think you'll get better than this. The image clarity is stunning. The colour representation is accurate. Some of the other phones tend to put a bit of a hue on it, or maybe they over exaggerate the blues and the greens and so on. But I have to say, I am obsessed, not to sound like an idiot, but there you go. As I said, I'll do the full review on the Pat Kenny show. But I have to say, I'm not missing the iPhone at all. The only painful part of moving from iOS to Android was moving my WhatsApps across. So just to explain how the process works, I set up the Pixel. I put in my Gmail address. I said I was setting it up or dragging content across from an iPhone. So I plugged a USB-C cable into both of the phones and just followed the steps on screen. When it came to the WhatsApp, it gave me a QR code on my new phone to scan, which I did. And I don't know if there was an interruption. I don't know if the cable came loose or whatever, but I'd gone through the entire setup process of it, downloading all my data, went to log into WhatsApp, and the stuff hadn't transferred, which was so annoying. So I had to go through the entire thing again. So my advice is just to make sure that you have a bit of time, that you're in an area of good connectivity and that the cable doesn't come loose. But beyond that, I have to say it is absolutely flying. And I'm also pretty happy with the Pixel Watch 3 as well. The interaction and the integration of Fitbit, it just kicks it up a notch. So anyway, full review to come, but first impressions are stunning. And speaking of wearables, actually, last week on the show, somebody asked about a Samsung watch and I got the names mixed up, which is, I think, an occupational hazard because there are so many. But the watch that I was thinking of was the Samsung Watch 7, and then there's the Samsung Watch Ultra. The Ultra is the one that is big and it's a little bit clunky on my wrist, but then there's the Watch 7, which is the closest to the Apple Watch or indeed the Pixel Watch 3 in terms of the neat design but high power, and would tick a hell of a lot of boxes for so many people. So if you are looking for a good Android watch, if you are a Samsung user, it's the Samsung Watch 7 that I would recommend. And if you are very outdoorsy and you're looking for something that's a bit more rugged, that's the Watch Ultra. Does that make sense? Right. That's it from me this week. If you missed any of the show, you can listen back in full on the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud. I'm actually off on Monday. I'm taking a day off, but I will be back with Pat Kenny on Tuesday. In the meantime, have a great weekend.